Today is July 16th, and my name is Ken Samuelson at 545 Southwood Drive in Eden, North Carolina. And my telephone number is 336-623-7787. And I'm here with Robert Stark. And Bob, could you give your name, date, and place of birth?
Robert J. Stark, Bozeman, Montana, May 6, 1921.
That's my birthday.
Is it?
10 years later.
Oh.
May 6th?
May 6th.
And so you were reared in Bozeman. What's your current address, Bob, and telephone number?
124 Meadowood Road, Eden, North Carolina.
Okay, and your phone number?
623-5370.
Okay. Bob, Bozeman, Montana is your place of birth. Is that where you entered the service, or...?
No, I entered the service in Nutley, New Jersey.
Nutley, New Jersey. How did you get to Nutley, New Jersey from Bozeman?
Well, I was adopted, and the family went to my home in Pennsylvania first, in Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh.
Both folks came from Pennsylvania, my mother from Beaver Falls, my father from Tarentum, New Jersey, Tarentum, PA. And we... got married, and we moved to Eden to get with the kids.
I see.
And
so how long have you lived in Eden then?
In Eden?
10 years or more, I suppose, huh?
Yes, it's more. I'll have to get Nader to
give
me a hand.
Yeah, I'm just curious. Okay, your address then at the time you entered the service and your age?
21. In Nutley, New Jersey.
And
that's the only draft I ever won.
And what was the date? When were you? What was the date of your entry into the service?
Oh, gosh.
Roughly, yeah, just.
Roughly, we'll come back.
After Pearl Harbor, I assume?
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So it 1942, was, probably.
It was in the draft. As I say, it's the only lottery I ever won. I came up 19th on the national and 16th on the local.
It must have been in 1942 if you were 21,
yeah,
being born.
And I was gone the next day.
Gone the next day. Now, what was your occupation when you had the service? Were you working at that
time? I was a crew chief.
No, before you went to the service.
Before I went, before I was a draftsman.
Draftsman, okay.
Right.
And you'd worked at that occupation a few years then?
Yes, quite a few years. And I went over to Bridgman. I was attached to MacArthur's headquarters as a map maker. And
so that your background helped a lot then.
Yeah, it did. Yeah. But I wasn't too keen on being stuck at MacArthur's headquarters. And I requested a transfer, and he gave me one to get back with my outfit, who had gone up to New Guinea.
Let's ask a couple more things here about you were drafted, I take it?
Yes.
You were drafted, and that was in 1942.
42.
And you were drafted into the Army Air Corps or into the Army?
Into the Army. Well, it was actually the Army Air Corps is what it was.
That you were drafted into the Army,
right.
Air Corps, not into
right.
the Army first and then transferred to the Air Corps?
No. At that time, it was the Army Air Corps.
Right. So you knew what you were getting into at that time. You knew you were going into the
yes.
Army Air Corps.
Yeah.
And not the Army, per se.
Right. I took my basic down in Miami Beach.
What did you know about the war before you went and you were in New Jersey and...
Well,
what were your impressions and what did you think about what was going on?
Well, really, it was just starting up, and I wanted to enlist, and I was a little bit young, and we planned to go up to Canada to enlist with the Canadians and get on over. But
this was prior to the time you were drafted, then
right,
you were already thinking about
right, just prior
enlisting.
To it, because I had friends that had already enlisted, and they had gone up to Canada and then on over, and I was trying to follow the same pattern.
So you were determined to get into the service? Is that the idea, one
yes.
way or the other?
Right.
And then
and
the draft
at the time
you.
I wasn't sure that we were going to get into it, but we sure did.
Yeah. Okay. So you were 22 when you entered the service?
21.
Excuse me, 21, and you were drafted in Nutley into the Army Air Corps. What, and you say you were drafted one day and you left when?
Right.
The next day?
Yeah.
You left the next day?
The next day.
They gave you one day's notice?
One day's notice. We had to re-enlist at our local office. And
draft board?
Right. And I came up on the
lottery,
and they took everybody right away.
You got one day's notice, and they told you to report the next day? And
right.
And where did you report the next day?
I went to Fort Dix.
And so you drove down, took the train or whatever?
Well, we took the train down. Actually, the Army took over.
Uh-huh.
And we were with them. I didn't have a car at the time, and it wouldn't have made any difference anyway. You still had to go with them.
Uh-huh. So you went to Fort Dix, and you, okay, you were with a large group of men, I take it then, that were drafted the same
right.
time you were? And what happened to you at Fort Dix?
Well, Fort Dix, I got my basic, and we went down to Miami Beach to complete the basic.
So your basic training was basically Army training at
Army
Fort Dix.
Training, right.
Okay.
And
not
then
Force,
not so much
not
at Dix. We got shipped out of Dix. We went to Miami Beach.
How long were you at Camp Dix?
About 3 days.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
They
We moved right out.
Is that right?
And then we went down to get our basic in Miami Beach.
And then was that at an Air Corps at the time?
Yes.
Base at that
right.
time? So you kind of skipped the basic Army training, went right,
right.
into the Air Corps.
We got
training.
It there, and then I went up to Jefferson Barracks, Missouri, and got the rest of my basic.
Uh-huh.
And then we went to California and shipped out.
What was your basic training? Of course, you didn't really have any at Fort Dix, so
no.
What was your basic training like down in Miami?
Well, it wasn't bad. It's mostly calisthenics on the beach and whatnot. They really didn't have an elaborate program at that time because we had to stay within the area of the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And they took over all the motels.
Mm-hmm.
And we just did most of the action on the beach. And I think there was a golf course that we used to drill on.
Uh-huh.
And that was about it.
And what, okay, you say it was conditioning training, and what
right.
else? Did you have any small arms?
No, we didn't really get into arms until we got to Jefferson Barracks.
Okay, so this
in
was,
Missouri.
So this was basically just conditioning and marching and this kind of thing?
Right, mostly drill.
And how long were you down there?
It was about a month.
About a month, and then you went up to Jefferson Barracks.
Then went up
Barracks.
To Jefferson Barracks. I
what
left
was,
the state.
What was that like, Jefferson
that
Barracks?
That was rather strict. We were considered the overseas group, which was kind of a joke because we didn't really have all that training, but we were the overseas group, and we trained there and got all our basics.
Now, was this basically Army training or anything related to the Air Corps yet?
Not Air Corps yet. It was
okay.
mostly the Army.
Okay.
And I didn't really get into the Air Corps until I went overseas.
But you knew you were going to be in the Air Corps from the beginning.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. And then I went to Port Moresby
uh-huh.
in New Guinea. And
okay.
there I really got the training for
yeah.
the Air Corps.
What was your day like at Fort Jefferson or Jefferson Barracks?
Mostly drill, hiking, and all the same, day in and day out.
Did you have any courses of study?
No, mostly manual.
Okay.
As a matter of fact,
physical stuff. Huh?
Physical, right?
Yeah.
And I was out on a hike when I got my shipping orders, and that's the first time I got to ride instead
now,
of walking.
At Jefferson Barracks, did you get involved in, small arms and this and bayonets and all the rest of it, or did you ever get involved?
No, just a little bit.
Uh-huh.
As I say, most of the actual arm training was in New Guinea.
I see. Okay.
Or I should say, prior to that, we went to Brisbane,
okay.
Australia. And we took our training there, and then we shipped north.
How long were we actually in Jefferson Barracks? Was that a couple months, or?
No, it was about a month and a half.
Month and a half, okay.
See, I was out of the country in 3 months.
So they were anxious to get you overseas?
Right.
They weren't gonna waste any time, or how? Did you have any spare time while you were in Jefferson Barracks, or any, you're down in Miami?
No, no.
Strictly,
Strictly training. I didn't...
24 hours a day, kind of?
I never got any leave in the service at all until I came home.
Uh-huh.
And that's the first, leave that I got.
You didn't have any spare time to speak of?
None at all.
To go into Miami, or, go into...
No.
Jefferson City, or whatever?
No, we couldn't go anyplace.
You couldn't go...
It was all training, hiking, and drill.
Sounds like a pretty committed existence there.
It was, very much so.
Okay, did you volunteer for any particular duty, or were you kind of told where to go?
We were told where to go.
Okay, so when did you get your orders? You got them at Jefferson Barracks, I take it?
Yeah.
And what did they...
Give me a minute, I think I have a...
Bob, you got your orders at Jefferson Barracks in maybe summer of 42, I suppose.
Yes.
Long time ago.
Right.
Okay, and that sent you where? Those orders sent you where?
From JB. Well, then we went up to Camp Stoneman, California,
mm-hmm.
For overseas shipment and training.
That was the
embarkation. Right.
Yeah, okay. And you were sent to New Guinea?
No, I went to Australia first.
Australia first. And how did you get to Australia?
By ship.
And so that was a long cruise.
30 days.
30 days.
30 days.
Were
California.
You escorted, or were you in any kind of a task force or anything?
No, we had a convoy. We had a destroyer escort.
Uh-huh.
And,
we
went all the way to Brisbane.
Okay. And what was that, Brisbane?
Oh, Brisbane was just a camp area.
Kind of a staging area.
It's a staging area for New Guinea.
Okay. And how long were you in Brisbane, do you recall? Just roughly, were you...
Well, it was a short period of time. Actually, okay. That was for about 2 to 3 months.
Okay.
And then when I got up to Townsville...
Did they give you any training at Brisbane, any special training?
Well, we had the usual...
What'd you do there?
...drill. And we had small arms training there. And then I went up to...
What kind of information did they give you about where you were going to go and what the status of the war was?
None. Everything was confidential.
Okay, so you...
We didn't get anything until we were ready to do something.
So basically you had no idea what the status of the war was?
Or no.
Did you get any... press releases from, not press releases, but releases from your commanding officer?
We didn't get anything until it was released for our action.
Uh-huh.
And then when we got into it, we had the minimum amount that you would get for training.
Okay. Okay, so then you left Brisbane and went where?
To Townsville.
Townsville. And is that New Zealand?
That's Upper New Guinea. Pardon me, that's Upper Australia.
Oh, okay, Australia. Okay.
That's before you go over to New Guinea.
Oh, okay.
And then they ship from there to Port Moresby. And at Port Moresby, you get your assignment to where you're going to go.
Had you seen your first airplane yet?
I didn't see it until I got...
Status, so to speak?
Not until I got to Moresby.
Now, had you been trained now as a crew chief at this point, or...?
No, I took my training as I went along.
Okay.
And,
So you don't feel like you were a qualified crew chief when you were at,
No.
This embarkation point, you know?
Our training there was to break down the planes for their 25, 50, and 100-mile inspections.
100-hour?
100-hour.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And we did that training, to these different inspections, and then...
And this was where now?
This started at Moresby.
Okay.
And we worked on the different areas there for quite a while. Moresby had a group that goes from, right at Moresby, and then so many miles out, like 3 mile strip, and whatever strip it happened to be operating from, they gave it in terms of the miles. And we moved through several of those strips
uh-huh.
until we got up to Goosop. We went from Nadsab, Goosop. Let me take it from the beginning. From Moresby to Silly Silly, to Nadsab, to Goosop, to Dumpool. And then we, at Dumpool, this is quite a bit later, we switched over to P-51s.
Okay.
And we, at that time, went back to Nadsab to have training for the P-51s.
Okay.
P-51s are metric, and Lindbergh was a company rep for the P-51s.
North American Aviation.
Right. You know, I was trying to think what engine that was.
Well, they had a couple engines of the P-51. Yeah. One was the Rolls Royce, I think.
Yeah.
And I've forgotten, you know, what the other one was.
Was it Avro Anson?
I don't think so. I think the Rolls Royce was the one that was...
Yeah. I think that's the one that Lindbergh was training.
Oh, okay.
And our main problem there was to get conversion for the tools.
Oh, they were metric? Yes.
They were all metric.
Yes.
And we didn't have tools available at the time. So Lindbergh trained the pilots, and he trained the crew chiefs on how to convert their metric system by modifying our tools.
Oh, you had to modify your
tools. We modified the tools, and then
so you had the planes before you really had the ability to support them properly, huh?
Right. I started off at that time with a P-47, and then went to a P-51.
Let's go back to Port Moresby a second. How long were you in Port Moresby? Do you recollect at all?
Yeah, Port Moresby is about 18 months.
Okay, so Port Moresby was a good part of your service then.
Yeah.
And now, Port Moresby was a prime target of the Japs. How did you determine that, or were you aware of it?
By the constant bombings that we had.
Okay.
We were a very short distance from the Japs.
Yeah.
And we very seldom got a warning. They usually bombed, and then we got the warning.
Oh.
But it was...
They were trying to get Port Moresby as a jumping-off place to Australia.
No, it's, they were.
They were.
Yeah, they were.
They were.
As a matter
of
fact,
that's why it was so important to them.
Yeah. And so they kept hammering at that.
Yeah. So what was your day like there in Port Moresby? You were there 18 months. And you were working on Thunderbolts there?
No, I started out in Moresby with the P-39s.
Oh, Air Cobras.
Air Cobras.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And then I went to the P-47s,
uh-huh.
And then the P-51s.
I see. What did you think about the Air Cobras or the Thunderbolts, the ability for them to withstand battle damage?
I think they were great. The Air Cobra was the most practical that I've ever seen. It was easiest to maintain. It had a tricycle landing gear, and they used to come in, and I've seen them come in on their bellies. We'd jack them up and put the wheels back down again and work on it, and they're off again. They're a fantastic plane to work on.
Why weren't they used more? Do you have any idea?
We were limited on what we could get. At that time,
I mean, the Air Cobra wasn't used... didn't really fly that much during World War II.
Oh, yeah, they did at Moresby for the first 18 months.
Yeah, but then they kind of faded out.
Well, they kind of faded out because the 47s came in, and they were better. The armament on the 39 was 330s on a wing,
uh-huh.
50 millimeter or a cannon through the prop, and two... I think there were 250s on the top that fired through the prop,
uh-huh.
Off the cowling, and they worked well, and they did a wonderful job. We didn't have too much air support then. We didn't have all the planes that we had. The Aussies came up later with the Boomerang, and they had that, and then we got the P-47.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like a big boomerang, and they were very effective. on strafing and dive bombing. We did a lot of support for the Navy at the Bismarck Archipelago. We did dive bombing and strafing up there. And it was mostly support all the way through.
Right. So what was a day like for you at Fort Moresby?
Well, bright and early rising, we'd get the planes ready, test flight them, pre-flight them, and get them ready for flight. And then the pilots would come out, and we would wait there until they took over the planes. And when they took off, we'd go back to the base and wait for their return. We ran several missions a day.
Uh-huh. And where were these aircraft usually headed? Where were they? What were the missions?
Well, mostly for ground support and support to the local islands.
Uh-huh.
And it was mostly dive bombing and strafing.
Mm-hmm.
And plenty of it, and they'd hire several missions a day.
So you'd get up real early, 4 or 5 o'clock?
Yeah.
Whatever. And you'd go out to the line, and you'd prepare the plane pre-flight it, does that include like making sure it's got the proper ammunition aboard and the
everything?
Or is it somebody else?
That's the armament group.
Okay.
The crew chiefs would start up the engines, warm them up, test them, pre-flight them, and check them at different RPMs,
mm-hmm.
and then cut it back and wait for somebody to come out and fly it.
Then did you top them off, top off the gas tanks and
always,
so forth
always.
Before the planes took off?
Yeah, everything, that was one of the part of the maintenance.
Uh-huh.
Would have them ready to go and fully equipped with gas.
And what distance were these aircraft able to fly? Do you have any idea what how far the targets might be?
Well, they varied.
How many hours would they be gone? Let's put it that way.
Well, they'd be gone 4 or 5 hours.
4 or 5 hours, okay.
And then they'd come back.
And they'd be out of gas,
they'd
basically?
They'd be out of gas.
Okay, so they got...
We had one of the longest flights that we ever had for a fighter group. I think it was from Najam to Borneo,
mm-hmm.
and back. I'm not sure of that. We just moved here, and most of the information I wanted to give you is still packed down in the garage. So you remind me again.
Okay, well let's continue on with your day. Now you got up early, you pre-flighted the aircraft, you ran the engines up and then topped it off and the pilot was ready to take off. Uh-huh. What did you do between the time the pilot took off then and he came back? And of course you'd already had a pretty good day.
We had our own groups, squadrons, and we would do inspections on other planes.
Uh-huh.
Keep everything up to date.
Did you have some planes, for example, that had battle damage and you had to work on those?
Yeah. No, there again, that's the armament group.
Uh-huh.
Would do all everything with the armament, the guns, ammo, everything.
How about a plane that was shot up?
Plane that was shot up, we had repair crews out there that would do the work on the cowlings and would take scrap planes and mm-hmm. cut them up and...
But that wasn't
build it
your
together.
Responsibility.
Yes, we did some of that too.
You did.
Yeah, okay. We did all the work on the planes.
Did you have any planes come back that you wondered how in the world they ever got back?
Yeah, many of them. they'd fly in, and I've seen them come in with no gas. I've seen them come in all shot up and crack up whenever they landed, and go to a long skid, and would pick them up and. Bring them back to the revetment area and work on them.
Uh-huh.
We didn't do anything that took more than 3 days for work that we could do. Otherwise, they were either shipped back or burned.
Oh,
or kept for parts.
You shipped them back to the States or
no,
to
no,
another
no.
area?
No, back to another area.
Uh-huh.
But we had to salvage all the parts that we could get.
Yeah. Okay. So during your 18 months at Fort Moresby, then this was kind of what you did, that whole 18 months.
Yes,
just
right.
Keeping those planes flying and supporting ground troops, or did you work with the Navy very closely in some things?
In some areas. As I said, they had the Bismarck Archipelago.
Uh-huh.
They supported that. Anything that they needed to support on, and you never knew what it was going to be.
Did you ever have occasion while you were in Port Moresby to fly anywhere or get up in the air with the, of course, these were all single seat planes, I guess.
I got a little bit tired of having all these bombs dropped on us, and which you can't defend. You just hide in a hole and wait. So I used to go up as a volunteer with B-24s, B-25s. I'd go up as a waist gunner.
Really?
Yeah. And we did that. Our cook in the camp there, he used to go up all the time because, you know, they had a couple days on, a couple days off. Well, he used to fly on his days off. And he got a couple of zeros.
No kidding.
And he used to have a frying pan that he had with all his flags on the frying pan.
So you went up. Did you have occasion to fire your waist guns in anger against any planes? Yeah, I'm talking about, did you fire them in anger against any planes?
Every time they arrived.
So you were into some air battles, I take it then.
Yeah. That's why I got so disgusted on the ground. When all you have to do is hide, you couldn't fight back.
Yeah.
We just constantly got lambasted.
Yeah.
And I wanted to get up and...
You wanted to get them back.
...be able to do something,
yeah.
And I did. And I was very dogmatic at that.
So about how many missions did you fly as a waist gunner or as a gunner board in? Would you fly B-24s and what else? Any 17s?
17s, 25s.
What were the primary planes they used at Port Moresby? Did they have a good assortment of all of those aircraft?
Well, that was it, 25s, 17s.
I know the B-25s were used a lot.
Yeah.
Particularly.
And then we got the P-38s later.
Uh-huh.
And
so you worked on all these as crew chief, is that right?
No, I only worked on the 39s and 47s. I never crewed a 38.
And then the 51s.
And 51s.
Yeah, okay. So it sounds like your 18 months was a pretty darn exciting 18 months.
Very much so.
Like I said, do you have any idea how many missions you flew, Bob, with as a waist gunner?
No.
Five or 10 or 20?
Probably 5 to 10. It wasn't enough to qualify for flight, for combat.
Uh-huh. I see.
Well, yeah.
What were your impressions when you were you taking somebody else's place that day? You weren't a regular crew member, right?
Right.
So you were taking somebody else's place then when you went up, or what?
No, well, it's either somebody else's place, or if they had an extra plane that they'd worked up, would fly with that.
Uh-huh.
I never knew who I was going to fly with.
Okay. Well, when you were flying, what was it like? You know, you took off, you had a long distance to fly, I take it, to drop your bomb load, and then
right.
A long distance back. And I guess this was in, this would have been 43, I guess, sometime when you were doing this.
Oops.
What was the status of the Japanese so far as their... ability to fight and defend themselves against the bombing attacks?
Very good at that time.
Very good at that time?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And as I say, they were superior as far as their planes went.
Yes.
You know, they did one thing that we should do, and we did later, and that was with a belly tank. They used to have a belly tank that was attached to the bottom of the plane. When they went into combat, they could throw that tank off in any position. Our tanks were always hung on the bottom, so we had to c-
come up at vertical and drop them so the bombs would leave the plane. We couldn't flip them off on that angle, and it made a big difference in the flight. They got into combat a lot quicker than we did. So it's quite a unbalance there.
Yeah. Did we ever make any changes on our planes to do the same thing?
No, we never did that.
That's surprising.
I take that back. The P-51, they had a spring-loaded tank that they used to fire out.
Mm-hmm.
They kicked it out.
They could get rid of the belly tank.
Yeah. And that that helped a lot.
Now, when you were flying these missions, were you escorted by these P-47s or Aircobras or whatever?
No, that was... If they were flying and my planes were up, then I'd be on the ground.
Excuse me, what I meant is, when you were flying your missions as a waist gunner, were you escorted by Air Cobras or Thunderbolts or whatever at the time?
Yeah.
Did they have escorts flying with you?
We'd have a different squadron. We had three squadrons in our group,
mm-hmm.
39, 40th, and 41st squadrons.
Mm-hmm.
And whoever was going up, they would escort the people.
Mm-hmm.
I could only do it on my, pardon expression, day off.
Did you? Did it give you a lot of comfort to see those planes flying out there with you?
Yeah, always.
And how effective were they when the Japs came in with their aircraft and trying to shoot the bombers down?
They were very good. They used to fly up above the planes,
mm-hmm.
and then as soon as anybody showed up, they'd jump right on them.
Okay, what altitudes did you fly when you flew in these bombing missions? Do you recall? Did you have cold, you know, cold weather gear on and so forth? I assume you did.
No, we didn't have any. We didn't have any gear. We went up around 10,000, sometimes up to 30.
Uh huh.
It'd be kind of cool.
I bet
we
you
had we had a jacket on, but I didn't have a, you know, an overall flight suit for it.
Uh huh. You got really chilly up there.
Yeah, I'd take an extra pair of pants and build it up that way.
Now, when you were at the waist gun, now this was an open area, right? Just like an open window,
right?
Could you close it?
No, it's open.
I mean, there's nothing
there,
close
but nothing there. The gun is mounted right in the window.
Uh-huh. So so when you fired the gun, you were like firing out an open window. And how much training had you had on firing these weapons, or had you done?
None. I learned on the way up. My first firing was on my first mission.
Is that right?
I fired on the way up and found out how to work the guns.
Where did you down any Jap planes by any chance, Steve, that you know of?
No, but I got some Jap boats on the strafing.
Uh-huh.
And that's when it got personal, because we came in and all these people were in the boats and they couldn't do anything. And
now, what kind of boats were these? Were these Navy, Jap Navy vessels?
Jap Navy vessels, small, something like a PT boat or an oversized life boat.
And they had
boat.
No way to defend
they
themselves.
Had, well, they had, they had machine guns on it.
Uh-huh.
And we used to get the gunner first and then come back and clean up.
Would that have been a mission primarily to attack these boats, or would this be part of a longer bombing mission, or what?
Well, either or both.
Either or both.
Okay. We never knew where we were going.
Yeah, you could have been sent specifically to blast those boats out of the water.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, so Port Moresby, so your 18 months basically was this kind of duty, huh?
Yeah.
Any unusual experiences on Port Moresby other than what you've already said that you can think of? Was this where, was Lindbergh there?
Lindbergh came in later at NADSAB.
Okay.
We were up north of that.
Okay.
And WEWAC. And we came back to NADSAB to get the training.
Okay, well, let's carry forward from Port Moresby then to where did you go after Port Moresby then?
Well,
and why?
Port Moresby to Silly Silly.
Why were they moving? What was happening at the time?
Well, we had to stay close to the Japs.
Oh, they were retreating, I take it, at that time?
Yeah. Well, we took over the bases, but we constantly moved up. We would be within 100 to 300 miles of a Jap strip.
So these islands that you kind of hopped to were former Japanese air bases primarily?
Right, and then we'd just switch and keep jumping up and to the next base.
So you were not on these each of those islands very long then, or were you? Did you?
Well, most of that was up to New Guinea. New Guinea is a long base.
So your primary idea was to get to New Guinea? Is that?
Well, from
jumping these
from
islands?
New Guinea, it's from Moresby on up to the end of New Guinea.
Okay.
And then up into the Halmaharas and so on. Up until Okinawa. Okinawa was odd. I was really scared when I came in, the first time we came in to see Okinawa, because it looked like it was loaded with giant pillboxes all over the mountain. But actually what it was a series of graves that were up there. I didn't know that it wasn't a pillbox. They would have like a horseshoe in concrete going up an embankment, and then doors down in the front. And that's why I thought they had guns that came out of those. Turned out that they were graves for the Okinawans.
Oh, I see.
They had inside the grave in the hill, they came in on the flat, went up with a couple of steps in the back, and they used to take the bodies in urns and put them on these steps. And a virgin had to keep moving the new dead in and shift the old dead down into smaller containers. And that's what they did in the back of the area.
So you thought these were, and I guess
we thought they were, they looked like pillboxes. It looked like a Maginot line. But actually it wasn't.
Okay, going back from Port Moresby then on these little island hopping escapades that your group was on. Was this a very short term on each of these islands, or did you spend any length of time on?
It varied.
What's the one that you spent the most time on before you went up to Okinawa? Any particular one that you remember?
Mostly through New Guinea, because it was all the full length of New Guinea from Moresby on up until we left it. Then we went to Biak. The Schulten Islands.
Biak?
Well, Biak, we had some airstrips up there, but we had a lot of trouble with Japs that had gone into the hills and were hiding. And when we came out to the line in the trucks, they used to lob grenades into the trucks. And
they could run right up to the airfield and lob a grenade in?
Well, on the way to the airfield.
On the way to the airfield, okay.
And they would come up. So we had to move over to Aoi, which was across from there, which was about 3.5 miles long. And then we didn't have the problems at that time with the Japs.
And they weren't over on.
They weren't on the island, so we could operate and do maintenance and.
What did you do? Kind of just ignore the Japs that were over in the other area then, or?
We had to leave that area.
Because they were so entrenched?
Yeah, we moved to the other island.
And did you?
They didn't have that many of them, but there was just enough to drive you crazy, because they would constantly hide, and whenever you went along the road, they'd throw these grenades in and wipe out half a crew.
Did you have any experience, personal experience, you can tell me about that, or did it ever happen to you?
All the time.
So you had grenades, Japs throwing grenades at your truck, huh?
Right. And it was.
And did you have any near misses on that, or you?
Had a couple. Had the engine blown off, and a couple of the trucks were ruined. But
you were not injured, I think.
No, I didn't get wounded. I was lucky.
Any of the men with you that were
some
hurt or killed?
Right. And we had some that came in on the strafing. At night, we get a lot of
the Japs were strafing.
Japs would be come in and strafe and bomb. We had a lot of these bombs that dropped down at
would really wipe things out. They have what they call a daisy cutter hill, because the hill had caves on the bottom, and the Japs thought we had things in the caves. So they used to come in and drop these daisy cutters. Daisy cutter, are you familiar with it?
Yeah, I know it explodes.
Yeah, right on the surface. Yeah. I don't think it'll leave any more of a hole than a large plate. Everything goes up.
Yeah.
And they used to drop those, and they would wipe anything out.
Now, this was at which island was this on?
They used it at all of them.
All of them.
As far as their equipment.
Mm-hmm.
But most of ours was up through the New Guinea area for the full length, and then we went to the Shulton Islands and then to the Philippines.
Were you on the Shulton Islands very long? Long time ago, I know.
Yeah. Well, there again, it was about 3 or 4 months.
Uh-huh.
We would move up.
And your activities were pretty much the same as they were?
Always.
Just
all the way through.
Just getting the planes ready to go.
Right. And pull inspections and get them ready for flight.
Yeah.
And then it got worse as we had more planes, because we had more work to do.
Yeah.
And keep them inspected and on the move.
Did you get the proper number of people to do the job, or did you just work longer and harder?
Longer and harder. We had each squadron that didn't have their flight up would work on another squadron's mm-hmm. planes, and we would rotate this way, so mm-hmm. it was constant work.
Did you have a lot of new people in there, or did you have kind of the same crew as you went from?
It was the same crew. We didn't get too many people there. At one time I had a sick leave to McKay in Australia. And Mrs. Roosevelt came over there with 5 senators to try to find out why we weren't being rotated.
Mm-hmm.
And she came down, and the MPs had come by and taken everybody out of the bars or whatever and brought them back to the Red Cross so she could come in. And she wanted to tell us that, don't worry, you'd have to go for your 18 months or whatever it was that you were supposed to serve, and then you'd be shipped right back. And she should have known better, because the fellows from New Guinea had all the old clothes, all washed and tanned out, you know. And we'd, like I say, they picked us up out of the bars, and we were sitting in the back. And she should have known better, or the senator should have kept her away from the guys in the back. So she came up and looked at this friend of mine, Rip Masters, and said, "Soldier, how many months have you been over here?" And he said, 36 GD months. And she said, "Oh dear," and she turned around, and she and the 5 senators left, and that's the last we saw of them.
You guys had all been there a long time,
sure.
Haven't you?
Excepting these new recruits that are just over there.
Yeah.
They're all in their new uniforms and wearing ties that were tucked in, which was kind of ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, let's just digress a second then. What kind of uniform did you wear when you were doing this in New Guinea and
up
the islands?
I had suntans, but they were all boiled in the water to clean them, and they're all faded out.
Is that what you worked in the suntans, or did
yeah.
you have dungarees, or what?
I had dungarees and the suntans.
What did you, when you're out on the line, what did you wear?
Either one or the other, whichever you had washed.
Well, you obviously get your suntans pretty dirty then, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, right. And when we came back, we didn't have anything clean. And like I say, she should have looked in the back and seen these fellas with shabby clothes. And
well, again, how did you get your uniform cleaned? Who cleaned them? Did you do it? Or?
We did it myself. I washed it in 100 octane gas.
Ooh, 100 octane gas.
Yeah, and when you start to sweat, it smarts.
And so there was no laundry facilities, any Army
no.
Air Corps laundry
no.
guys around or whatever?
No.
You just did it yourself?
We had
55-gallon drums that were cut in half. We filled that with soapy water and a couple of other drums that were rinses. You went through three rinses after you boiled them.
This is an editor's note. End of tape A, side one. The interview continues on tape A, side two.
I take it there was no smoking, Bob.
No.
Oh, you blast everybody to smithereens.
No, we had nothing to clean them with. You ask about the food. The food was terrible.
What did you? What kind of? Well, who cooked your food?
We had a cook, but the food that they got was corned beef and hash.
Uh-huh.
We had 96 consecutive meals of corned beef and hash.
Is this, you talking about breakfast, lunch, and dinner?
Yeah, the whole bit.
Corned beef and hash. Oh my gosh. So, was there any special treat that you got now and then from anybody, the Red Cross or whoever, you know? Did you get anything special ever?
No.
Any package? How about packages from home or whatever?
Well, we had packages come home, but our mail was usually held up for about 3 to 5 months until they could get it to us.
So if it was a cake, it was long gone anyway.
Oh, yeah. We never got any food sent over.
No food sent.
It would never make it. It was always robbed before it came up.
Oh, you wouldn't get it anyway, in other words, huh?
We wouldn't get it anyway.
You wouldn't get it anyway, okay. I'm sure the censors would take all the food. How about the supply system for your parts and everything? Did you have any trouble getting parts for your planes?
Yes. We didn't get too many parts flowing in. The only thing we could do was salvage all the wrecks.
Cannibalize your plane?
Yeah.
Did you get many new planes in? Did they fly many?
No.
You just tried to keep the old ones flying?
The old ones gone.
So you really didn't get much in the way of replacement planes then, huh? How about bombers either?
They were the same way.
So you guys had to make do.
We had, we did have a bully flight on one of the B-25s. They used to go to Australia and buy rations down there. We used to make a collection for whatever money we could get, and they would buy us food from Australia.
So that was your special treat every now and then, huh?
Right.
Yeah. And that wasn't very often, I take it, huh?
No.
Okay. So, you know, from what I understand, you know, the emphasis during World War II was on the European theater until Germany surrendered. So, could you say that you were kind of getting the short end of the stick out there in the Pacific? Is that fair to say that?
Well, yeah.
And planes and everything?
I don't know how bad it was in the European theater. I know eventually after the war was over in Europe, we got their flights that came over to support us.
Uh-huh.
And then rations got better and we got more supplies.
But basically, you had to kind of make do with what you had.
Salvage whatever you could get.
So you were definitely short on material and supplies and what have you. Okay. How about your leadership? Who do you reported to? You had a commanding officer, I guess, and you had an officer in charge of your particular unit that you were. What did you think of the leadership of the folks that were?
I thought it was very good. We had the leadership in the camp area, which was everybody associated with the camp.
Uh-huh.
The flight crews and the line was maintained by the line personnel.
Uh-huh.
And they would be the ones that would bring us the most of the instructions.
Did you have many professional Air Corps guys there, or were they primarily just people like yourself?
People like myself, but we rotated the pilots. They came in, and whenever they could after their 25, their, I forget how many missions was the basic, they'd go and would get another pilot and would take care of the plane.
So 25 missions for the fighter pilots was true also, they would be rotated?
Yeah.
Or was 25 as far as you know, or not 35, 25?
Well, I think it was 25. Yeah. I'm not sure of that count. Try to remember that.
That was 35 in Europe.
But they rotated, and then we get another pilot.
Uh-huh.
And
did you get to know any of the pilots particularly, or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I got very close to several of the pilots.
Any of them that were became well-known due to their fighting record, or planes that they had downed and so forth?
Yeah, they had the aces that were there. Like Kirby, he wasn't from our group,
uh-huh.
but Kirby was an ace. Bong was an ace.
Bong, was he there?
Yeah.
Richard Bong was there?
Yeah, Bing Bang Bong. He was
Bing
there.
Bang Bong. Richard Bong, he flew, yeah. Oh, that's a well-known name.
Yeah.
That's a well-known name. So he was on, did you have any occasion to interact with him or anything? Or did you just know him by sight or whatever?
He wasn't with me. Lindbergh I did, because he trained us for the P-51s.
Yeah.
We modified our tools to his specs.
Why don't you tell me about Lindbergh? Go ahead and how did you happen to, what's the first time you met him, and what circumstances? And
that was interesting, because I met him, I was up in northern New Guinea, and I forget where it was that I started from, but I came back to NADZAB, and he was there, and he was training the pilots to fly. And he taught the crew chiefs how to convert their tools to do the maintenance on a plane.
He was real hands-on, I take it?
He was very much hands-on. I was very surprised to see him there, to tell you the truth. Yeah. My last recollection of him was when he was, I was in New Jersey when his baby was kidnapped.
Yeah.
And then he went to England, and that's the last I ever heard of him.
Well, he got a real, he was accused of a lot of things.
Yeah.
That were
right
unpatriotic, you might say.
Yeah, and I was very surprised to see him show up over there. And then, as I say, he's a very likable man, and he showed us all we needed to do, and he's very conscientious about what he did. And I understand that he went up with Bong and got himself a zero. I talked to the library in preparation to your coming to see what if they had any record of that. And they said that he had flown 50 missions.
Yeah, that's what I understand.
I didn't realize that. I thought he had only flown the one that when he went with Kirby. He
flew a lot of missions.
But he was very conscientious.
So how long was he over there with you? Do you have recollection of that?
No, it's a short period of time. It was just a month or two.
Mm-hmm. But he was there a month or two with your group, huh?
Because it's just long enough to convert the planes and train the pilots.
Did you ever get your metric tools in?
Never did.
You never got metric tools?
Never got them.
So you had to take your, what do you call them? Not metric, but English.
We had to modify those, grind them down to fit.
Okay.
And he did a very good job in converting. But I never got any of the tools.
Amazing.
It was impressive to me when I met him, because I met him at in NADZAB in Leh, and that's where Amelia Earhart made her last flight. It was on that strip that I first met Lindbergh.
Is that where Amelia Earhart took off from?
Yeah.
On her last flight?
That was her last flight.
Is that right? Yeah. And you said Leh?
Leh.
L-A-E?
L-A-E.
Yeah.
Leh, and then below that was NADZAB.
Yeah, okay.
And that's where we had the training.
Uh-huh. Getting back to your officer corps, were most of your officers, what they call 60-day wonders, or did you have any academy men there?
Well, we had a wide variety. Most of them were made in the field on their flights. A lot of them were I guess, direct pilots.
Mm-hmm.
But...
How about your officer corps that you reported to? Were they primarily civilians drafted in, or drafted, or actually...
Mine were, yes. And as I say, they varied because I had a constant change of pilots as we went along.
Uh-huh.
And they finally started to move out. The pilots moved out before the men did on transfers.
Did you have any academy men that you know of? Or were they primarily all men?
I don't know for sure.
Yeah, okay.
I
was wondering if you could tell any difference between the people who are trained, you know, at the, West Point or whatever.
No.
Versus the...
No, ours is a very tight-knit group.
Uh-huh.
And they work well with the men. We never did all this saluting and whatnot over there. We just did the work together.
Uh-huh.
And we had no real military establishment there.
You didn't go by the what you would say the rules of the Army, huh?
No.
More informal and just
get
the job done.
It's informal and got the job done. And everybody worked together. When we had worked on our planes where we had to drop tanks and whatnot, I've had the pilots come in and help us raise tanks.
Tell me about the tanks. How many, do you recall how many gallons a drop tank would hold? A couple hundred gallons?
I'm trying to think.
So that gave an
extra... I think it was 250 or 500 and 1,000 gallon. We didn't use 1,000 gallon too much because they were too low.
Uh-huh.
And the obstructions on the field were bad. We had a corps of engineers that worked with us. It's 96th engineers.
Uh-huh.
It was a black group. They're very efficient. And they did a wonderful job in taking care of the strips. Whenever we moved into an area...
What kind of strips were there? Were this metal, expanded metal kind of strip?
We had some that used to lay down.
Uh-huh.
Over the strip. Some of it was on coral that was rolled. All the equipment had to be airborne. Like if you had the bulldozers or anything like that, they were all things that could operate with a Jeep. And they could be airborne and taken up in a 47.
Oh, I see.
And anything that could go in a 47 could go up.
Uh-huh.
But we didn't have any heavy stuff. It was all flown in.
Uh-huh. Okay. How was the discipline in your group?
Very
you have
good.
Any problems with people running AWOL or
never.
Whatever? Yeah, never. No place to go, I guess,
no
anyway.
No place to go. No.
You couldn't go anywhere.
They couldn't go anyplace. They didn't want to.
Yeah. They were committed to
They were committed, and it was a very tight group.
Were there many, these islands, were there many natives that you had occasion to interact with or anything?
Yeah, we had some. I've shown the pictures. You can go through them.
Yeah, I saw some
later, that showed some of the natives that came in. They helped unload some of the planes. And you had to be careful with the natives because they didn't understand too much. We have some of them that had never heard any music before, Victrola or anything like that. And we have some pictures in here that show them listening to their first recording.
Is that
it's
right?
It's really fantastic.
Did you ever take a picture, have occasion to take a picture of one and give them a picture of themselves and this kind of thing?
Oh yeah, that's appalling. You got to be careful of that because they used to think that was their spirit.
Yeah, that's
and if
what
you captured their spirit,
they would die.
They would die.
Yeah.
So you had to be very tactful on how you presented anything like that.
So did the natives assist you then, maybe in, say, repairing airfields when they were bombed or strafed or whatever? Did you?
Well, they used to do the manual labor on it. When we couldn't get the bulldozers in, we used to use them more for cutting down the growth where the strip would be.
Did you pay these people, or did they volunteer to do it, or what? How did that
they
work?
Got food, and that was it.
They got food.
Yeah.
So this was all kind of unofficial then, the fact that they were...
Get that machete, will you, Jim?
So this was all kind of unofficial, the fact that they were working. They were basically volunteering for food.
Yeah,
basically.
Right.
Okay, I'm looking here at a machete that Bob has. Boy, what a...
Watch the edge. It's still quite sharp.
Yeah, I can see. That is something else. And you got this in New Guinea, or...?
Yeah. The crew that I had working for me, they...
Now, who made this?
The natives did.
Natives made this.
I don't know how they cured their steel.
Yeah,
That steel is the sharpest...
I can see.
Take a look at that, Jim. That's the sharpest thing I've ever seen, and they... Really, really great with it.
Amazing, and made out of wood there, right?
Yeah, right.
With sinew or whatever it is.
Yeah.
That's an impressive piece. It's about, 22 inches long, something like that. 2 feet, almost 2 feet long. Well, not quite. Yeah, probably 2 feet long with a handle. Yeah, that's interesting. With a wooden scabbard. And one of the natives gave you that, huh?
Yeah.
What had you done to deserve that? What did you...
I had them as a work crew.
Uh-huh.
And I used to make them do whatever we needed.
Uh-huh.
And they worked well with me. And when I was about to leave, they made that for me and gave it to me.
That's nice. That is something. Well, it's...
I don't know if the steel came from Australia. It probably did.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no telling where, huh?
That's a caribou handle.
Oh, caribou horn? What?
Right.
Or bone or whatever?
Well, it's a horn, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so getting back to your crew, it was a very close-knit crew, including the officers and the men, huh? They were all real close-knit, just getting the job done.
Right.
And with very little, you might say, official Army regulations. Army Air Corps regulations.
As a matter of fact, we never saluted or called them, sir. We called them by their name.
Uh-huh. That's interesting. Did you have any trouble with fraternization with the natives or anything? Did any of the guys get in any trouble on that score?
No.
How about the fact, there's
a lot of disease with those natives.
Yeah.
Anybody that fooled around with a native was going to be in trouble.
Yeah. How about drugs? Obviously, you didn't have drugs or anything
like
that. Gambling, was that a problem?
No.
Particularly?
Oh, we all played the dice.
But it wasn't
It was
entertainment.
Just entertainment. It's about the only thing we had.
How about any discrimination for any reason between you and any of the people that were in your unit or other units?
No.
No problem. Y'all just doing a job?
We didn't get into any discrimination until we came back to the States.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So
I mean, the discrimination that is we see in the U.S., in other words. Or are you talking about in the military?
I'm talking in the military.
Okay. Well,
like when we came back, of course, I was a sergeant at that time, tech sergeant.
Uh-huh.
And I came back, and all the, from staff sergeant on up, all had quarters together,
uh-huh.
private rooms. We didn't stay with the troops.
Uh-huh.
But that was all broken up. I didn't realize at first. I just thought it was, you know, a standard group because, like I say, we were all staffs and techs, masters.
Oh, so you're saying discrimination in the fact that you were given
by rank.
Special treatment by
rank,
yeah. But still no particular discrimination by race or religion or anything of that nature. Okay. Did you have any spare time at all during all this business? We haven't gotten to Okinawa yet.
Not really.
But you didn't really have any spare time. So you were basically felt like you were on duty 24 hours a day.
Right.
You just did whatever you had to do.
So that's right.
Did you, let's carry on to after these lay where you...
Bloomberg's. Can we hold up a minute?
Yeah, sure. Okay, continuing on here, Bob, you left Lay, then and I believe you went to Okinawa at that time. How did you get to Okinawa, by ship?
Yes, but we didn't get to Okinawa yet.
Oh, okay.
We went up to the Philippines.
Oh, went to the Philippines, okay.
And then that was in Dagupan, and all on Luzon.
Okay, was this right after the Philippines were retaken, then I take it, immediately after that?
Yes, right. We came back with MacArthur.
Yeah.
Not quite later.
Oh, a little later.
I shouldn't say this. He was too damn much of a showman for me.
Well, a lot of people say that.
And I didn't feel that I liked him as much as some. We had some Australian generals that I'd met, General Blimey.
Uh-huh.
And I met him one time. He came up, this was in New Guinea, and we had one of these quick raids, and Blimey's up there looking around, you know, and I kicked him in the ass and knocked him into the slit trench, and I dove in on top of him. And one of the natives dove in on top of me and pissed over both of us. Oh, I'm sorry. We're still recording. But
a little local color here.
He really let wide.
What did he say when all that happened?
Well,
did he thank you or did he cut you out?
Well, he thanked me. And when he said, "I don't advise anybody else to try this."
So how long were you in the Philippines then, Bob? Not very long. What did you do there?
Well, same thing as a crew chief.
Okay. So you're an air base on the Philippines? And
a strip, not an air base.
A strip, okay.
We...
you have fighter pilot, fighter planes particularly, or bombers too? Or?
Well, everything. I was a bomber assist. They would be on different strips, but they'd go up and then we'd join them for support.
Uh-huh.
And I think I mentioned before that it got a little bit boring not being able to fight back. So, did I mention that our cook
had
a frying pan with a couple of flags on it? You had to do something to... relieve the tension, because whenever you're in a trench and these bombs come whistling down, they have their own screech, and when they start to hit, they start walking towards you with a whoomp, 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 and coming right towards you. And I tell you, it really unnerves you.
I would say it does. What did you think when this was going on? Why is this happening to me? What did you think when that was going on?
Not really. I was just watching where they were hitting and trying to figure out what they were going to do. And we made L trenches.
Uh-huh.
I tried to get the pattern of which way they were coming in so that they wouldn't strafe to the length of the trench. We switched around to the other half.
Uh-huh.
And got the protection of a narrow opening.
Yeah. Who dug these trenches?
We did.
So that was part of your job too, then,
yeah.
Get these trenches dug.
I used 100 sticks of dynamite one time to make a single trench that was about the length of this table both ways.
You couldn't find a better place to put it?
It's all solid coral.
All solid coral, huh? So you used 100 sticks of dynamite to
blow it up.
To create a trench.
So, that wasn't too wide. I mean, it was so shoulder wide.
Now, did you have to, these trenches, they weren't your trenches. They were just a trench for anybody that was near.
No, they were our trenches.
They were your trenches. Okay.
We put them outside of our tents.
Okay.
So you could roll out of bed when they started a bomb and drop into a trench.
Now, were you
stay there?
Okay. When you were in the Philippines, were the Japs still pretty aggressive, bombing and strafing then, or were they kind of
I had started a tape up. Off, but they were pretty active.
Did you have any Japs up in the hills that you had to deal with?
Yeah, but most of that was taken care of with the Navy. With the
blasting them out with their guns, huh?
Right. And that was true also with Okinawa. They did the same thing.
Did you have any occasion where the Japanese would, you know, try and infiltrate your area and so forth and do some damage that way?
Yeah, that'd come up. As a matter of fact, I was pre-flighting one morning, and I happened to be looking in the mirror, and I had a Jap that tried to come up over my wing.
You're kidding.
No, he tried to.
Gravy.
So I revved her up and swung him around, and I hit him with the prop.
Oh, ho, 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 ho. You hit him with the prop. That took care of him.
Yeah, it took care of my prop, too. It made me so damn mad. I had to change the prop.
But it's saved your life, maybe. He was armed, I take it.
Oh, yeah.
Wonder why he didn't just open up, fire.
I don't know why.
But you saw him, and you...
I saw him. I think he had a knife. I don't know that he had a gun.
Uh-huh.
But I saw him coming up over the side of the plane.
And you started... The engine was running at the time?
I had it all already running, and I was pre-flighting, and just it was on low RPM. And I looked up, and here he is coming up. So I just...
Oh, you revved it up?
Yeah. I revved it up and kicked my brakes off and swung around and got him.
Oh, okay. So the plane actually swung around and the prop hit him. Yeah. Is that the idea?
Right.
Good gravy.
No, I kicked my brakes off.
So you hit this Japanese with a prop, and that was all she wrote. Huh?
Right.
Any other experiences that you can think of where the Japanese were trying to infiltrate your area particularly?
Well, I'd mentioned about Bayak. When they were coming up there, we had trouble with them.
Yeah, we're throwing.
Because they used to throw grenades.
Grenades.
And then we had to move. We actually had to get out of there because they're so prevalent.
Yeah.
They had caves that they would hide in, and they'd come out at night and go through the camp areas and try to get you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, in the Philippines, then. How long you might have been in the Philippines before you went on
I'm not sure. As I said, we kept moving up.
Yeah, you did the same thing every day, I guess.
Yeah.
And of course, your pilots were flying missions all day long, were they
all
not?
All day long.
So you were going all the time.
They got more and more missions towards the end of the war.
Yeah, they were able to fly more because they weren't getting...
We didn't have the interference that we had.
Right, exactly. And your planes were primarily escorts for B-29s or?
Escorts and then our own fighter support for strafing and groundwork.
Groundwork on some of the other islands out there where the Japs were still. Okay. Okay. What was the health of your unit? Did many of your people have health problems because of being in the tropics over there?
Yeah, we all got the different fevers, the dengue, and malaria, and fungus. I had fungus on my ears, and a lot of fellows had fungus on their eye, and we had to get treatment for that.
Did many fellows really lose their lives because of this, or were they just a big, terrible annoyance, or what?
No, it was an annoyance. They had a lot of trouble with malaria. We used to get quinine, and then we got Adabrin, and we took them on a daily basis. And I had a large amount of Adabrin, so much that it's a yellow pill.
Yeah.
And your skin turns yellow, and you could get away with it like it was yellow jaundice, excepting for the fact that your eyeballs would not turn red. Some of the guys used to try to get a leave based on having jaundice,
Oh, and it was really just Ativan, huh?
And it was just an Ativan tan.
But other than that, your eyes would actually turn red if you had jaundice. Is that the idea?
Yeah, right.
But Ativan, they wouldn't turn red, but your skin would turn yellow.
Right, that'd be white. And I didn't get rid of the Ativan until about 6 months after it was out.
No kidding.
I had to work it out of my system. My clothes used to turn yellow all the time with the perspiration.
Is that right?
And I finally got rid of it.
You mentioned that some of the guys tried to, you know, get home and say they had...
No, not home. Junk. They wanted to get leave.
Get leave, okay.
They wanted to go back to Australia on a leave.
Oh, okay. So they were just, they wanted to temporarily get out of there. And
right.
Then they knew they'd have to come back. But,
well, they had to come back.
They
tried to pull that, but it didn't work.
Did you have any medical doctors there? Were they just medics that you...
No, we had medical doctors. We had...
Is this on the Philippines now, I take it?
Well, always. We always had a medical doctor.
You always had a medical doctor.
And we had the medics.
Uh-huh.
And they took care of dispensing the pills and whatnot.
Did you ever have any abuse of alcohol that was in the possession of the medics and so forth? Any that you know of? Anybody get into the alcohol locker?
Well, some of the guys used to get into alcohol once in a while, myself included.
It all comes out now, okay.
Yeah. No, we had it once in a while. We never had anything over there. And about the only time that you could get anything was to get some alcohol. Then later, when they had better shipping facilities, they used to bring us the medical alcohol from Australia, and they'd throw a GI party. And they used to pass it out.
I see. You ever have beer? I mean, particularly, beer available to you?
Or? Later in the war, we got beer rations.
Soft drinks, Coca-Cola, anything? I mean, did you ever get any of that stuff?
Yeah, they had some soft drinks, Australian stuff.
That they'd pick up when they took their trip to...
Yeah, well, most of our supplies came from Australia.
Uh-huh.
We didn't get all the American stuff. Used to get me because I get letters from home saying, you know, we don't mind giving it up as long as you people are getting it.
But you never got it.
We never got it. I don't know where it went.
It was stopped halfway by some censor, I'm sure.
That's right.
We can't let these boys have this. Okay. What did you know about what was going on in the war? Were you still kind of kept in the dark? Were you getting any publications at all that you could read?
We did honor offensives.
The Army News, what did they call it? I've forgotten the name of it.
Geez, I got one of those.
Yeah, I can't even think of the name of it now.
The Yankee Clipper was one of them. And that was another one, the official one.
Yeah, right. I can't.
We got that.
But anyway, you got that. Did you get that regularly or so often? Or?
Well, we got it every so often. Towards the end of the war, we got it. And then...
Stars and
Stripes,
yeah,
right.
That's what I'm trying to say.
And then whenever I shipped out, as I said, I always get a job with a crew or doing something. And one of my jobs was with the reporter as on the ship. And we used to get the stories from some of the fellows from Stars and Stripes. And we used to get the reports from the different enlisted men.
Uh-huh.
And we wrote our articles from them and kept it active. We had one fellow.
Who did you send these articles to?
Distributed on
board the ship?
Ship's papers.
Okay.
And
this is why you're like several days at sea going
place to place. And when you're on a boat a month, you want to keep abreast.
Yeah.
And we used to put some of the news on that.
Uh-huh.
And we used to get some of the fellows and interview them.
How much was filtering down, though, to you from official sources? Was it mainly through the Stars and Stripes, then, I guess?
No, we got a lot of through the intelligence.
Uh-huh. And it was promulgated to the guy on the line, huh?
Right. And
so you knew pretty well what was happening, huh?
Pretty much, but this was in the later stages.
Yeah.
Early stages, we didn't get anything.
You didn't get much.
And they didn't publicize any of this because in a lot of cases you'd be divulging your own secrets.
Tell me about Tokyo Rose. You ever hear her?
All the time.
What did you think of what she had
to
say?
That's very demoralizing because when you had nothing and they'd tell you about these big Christmas dinners and things that they were having, and they used to take the names from people that they could get. I don't know where they got them, or they just picked a city and say, you boys from Des Moines or whatever you happen to be from. They go through a day's date on there, and I try, this really hits you hard when they go through a date and you're stuck in a trench. Listen to her plaster you with this.
What is she saying?
Well, she'd make up a big date and say, how would you like to be home doing this?
Yeah.
And she'd go through a whole date with you.
Oh, okay.
And I tell you,
go
really,
dancing, go out for dinner.
Yeah, you know, a whole bit. Really tear you apart.
Yeah. And you, now you had radios, I take it then, obviously. You had to have a radio.
Yeah.
Was this your, it wouldn't be your personal radio, it would be your base radio or something?
Or we had the radio on the plane.
Oh, okay. The radio on the plane picked it up. Okay. So you could turn on the radio on the plane then and listen as you were working on the plane. Is that the idea?
Well, no, actually, we couldn't because there again, we had the electrical system out while we were doing other work.
Okay.
But we used the supply from some of the supply bases would use their radios to pick it up.
Anyway, you were in a position to hear this.
We could hear this.
Did you ever hear any other broadcasts other than Tokyo Rose? It was all Tokyo Rose business. Did you ever get any from the States?
No. Yeah. I'm trying to think. We did get some. We got some from Australia and from Darwin.
Uh-huh.
And some from Townsville.
Well, let's get on up to Okinawa. Tell me about that. You got to Okinawa and from the Philippines, and what was that like? Was it pretty well subdued when you got there, then, I think?
Yeah, we bombed out most of the strips up there. And it was very hard to establish where you were because everything was... Well, they had these tombs that were in the in the mountains, and they were cut out. It would be like a big horseshoe, and then I mentioned before that they had the openings and the doors on the bottom,
right?
And they used to be inside these tombs, and the Japs used to find corridors from one tomb to another. So they used to roam all around the island, jumping from one tomb internally to another.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'd come out and bomb or strafe with the, what I want to say, these small anti-personnel bombs and whatnot that they'd throw.
Oh, okay. So they would throw a... Like hand grenades, are these some kind of mortars or something, or what was
that? Well, a mortar, a hand grenade, or anything that was propeller.
And a lot of small arms fire, I guess.
Yeah,
being used.
And they had that, and as I say, on that area, we had to get out because you couldn't operate with everybody coming up and getting you when you were either going out to or from the strip.
Yeah,
we had a hard time at that.
So tell me about Okinawa then. It was pretty well taken at the time. I mean, it was subdued at the time you got there.
Completely. I went up to Naha to get some orders. Then Naha itself was just leveled.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went up and found the bases and then came back. But they completely wiped it out.
So you were doing the same thing in Okinawa then that you'd been doing everywhere else.
Right.
I mean, this is doing your bombing runs and
same fighter. Same thing.
And And at that point, of course, I guess the Japs, their offensive capability was almost...
No, it was zilch. We didn't have trouble with the raids. Uh-huh. It was very seldom that you had a raid when they didn't. Oh, there was two. I'm trying to think. It was Halmahera, and directly opposite Halmahera was another island, and I forget what it was.
Uh-huh.
And they used to come from that island over to Halmahera, and they were very clever. I had my pilot take me up once on a flight.
Now, what kind of plane were you in?
That was a P-47.
Oh, how did you get two in a plane?
We had took out the Christmas tree tanks in the back, and we made a seat back there so the pilots could take a passenger up.
Okay.
And I was up with him, and we were going along, and we just happened to look out onto this strip that looked like it was ruined, and we saw a tail of a plane being tucked away into the woods. And the Japs were clever. They took asphalt and put it onto the concrete strip so that whenever you took pictures of it from the air, it looked like it was all bomb craters all over that strip.
Oh, yeah.
But actually, it was very good.
Yes.
And we saw this plane being wheeled away.
Now, where actually was this plane? What island was this now? Was this one you were taking off from Okinawa?
Well, yeah, but there was another island over there, and I forget what it was.
Okay, but there was still some Japs there.
Yeah, and they were wheeling it in, and this is where we were getting all these raids from.
Ah, okay.
And so we radioed that in, and then they took off with the fighters, and they came up and they joined us, and then we strafed the whole area. And I never got so sick in my life because I just wasn't up to dive bombing and strafing.
Okay, so you were a passenger as they were doing this?
I was in a passenger in my
plane. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
And in a P-47.
Yeah. And he radioed for help, and they got the other planes up, and we joined them. And he got me so sick that I couldn't even stand up. I got out of the wing of that plane, and I laid on that wing, and I just heaved everything I had. I never got so sick in my life.
Was that the first and only time you went up like that, or did you go up several times like that?
I've been up before in other planes.
But you hadn't
but
been
But I had never been into combat.
In a combat mission.
And, boy, he just jerked me all over that plane. And I tell you, I was never so sick in my life because you get the dry heaves afterwards, you know. And I just laid there limp.
How
and if I could have stood up, I think I would have belted him one.
Let me stop.
This is an editor's note. End of tape A, side 2. The interview continues on tape B, side 1.
So in Okinawa there, how long were you on Okinawa? Do you recollect how long you were on Okinawa?
No. I'm afraid I'm going to have to let you down on time. It's been so long. I
forget. Yeah, well, I know. But,
If we get that garage fixed, and I can get some of my papers out.
But you were doing the same thing all the time you're on Okinawa. You're always doing the same thing, basically.
No,
just keeping the planes
just
flying.
Just keep the plane flying. And,
So and eventually, the Japs, of course, tell me about VE Day. Now, you heard about VE Day somewhere along the line, victory in Europe. What was your thought then?
It was great for VE Day.
Did you have a celebration anywhere on the base, or did?
Yeah, that's when we got some of that denatured alcohol.
You had a little party, huh?
I tell you, that hospital alcohol is rough. But no, we had this celebration, and then they came over. From the European theater over to join us. And we got some of the European squadrons over there. Yeah.
Did you get any new, is that when you got the P-51s then, or did you already have
No, we'd already had the 51s.
Uh-huh.
But they brought the additional planes over.
Yeah, so all of a sudden you had...
We had an abundance of everything. The A-20s, B-25s, and B-24s.
Uh-huh.
They were the fighting crew that you needed over there, and they were tremendous.
How were the B-25s used? I mean, they weren't a long-range bomber. What did you...
They were used for bombing and strafing.
Uh-huh.
The windows on the back where the guns were,
uh-huh,
was where we had a 50 caliber gun in there,
uh-huh,
on either side. And they used them for support and bombing. And then in the nose you had, I think it was 850s.
Yeah. I understand that. Didn't they turn some of those B-25 into just a big gun platform? I mean, just with all kind of guns and cannons and everything else?
Yeah. Yeah, that they did. But it was all rigged, as I said, through the nose. We had 850s. We had 50s on a wing, or not on a ports on the side of the plane.
Uh-huh.
And that was 250s there. And 250s on the opposite side.
So it was really well armed.
It's well armed.
Okay. Tell me what your opinion was or is of the enemy. What did you think as you were you pretty impressed with their capability, their organization, and
I was in the beginning, because they were really superior. They almost came into Australia.
Yeah.
And
if they'd gotten Port Moresby, they would have.
Yeah. Probably. And we got quite a bit of action down there, and when they were in their main run, when they had all the zeros and whatnot, they were very efficient.
Very formidable, huh? tell me about the morale of your unit all along. Was it pretty good, or did you?
It was pretty good.
What affected morale most? Now, you talked about Tokyo Rose. That was a downer.
That was a bummer. But
how about mail and things like that? Did you?
Yeah, and not getting packages or not getting anything through to you.
Yeah.
This was hard, and it made particularly hard when we had Tokyo Rose.
Yeah.
Compounding the effect.
Yeah, telling all the things you're missing at home. Huh?
Right, and then we didn't have the food.
Mm-hmm.
At Christmas we had bully beef and stuff like that, and then finally
anybody put up a Christmas tree at Christmas time? Something that looked like a Christmas tree?
Well, we didn't have anything to celebrate it with. They painted coconuts and tried to, you know, make it look like a tree.
Yeah.
But that was the hardest part on seasons when you have your family.
Tell me about the psychological stress that you feel like you went through. What did you, were you just on a roller coaster the whole time, or how did you feel about all this going on?
It was very hard, and the lack of sleep and the raids kept you strung up pretty tight, and they had a lot of people that cracked under that, because it goes on for days and months.
Any guys in your unit that?
Yeah, we had quite a few of them.
What were the symptoms that you know, what happened when they?
Well, they just get hysterical, and really crack up, break down and sob. Real nervous breakdown.
And were these people sent back? What were the R&R? Did they ever come back to your unit, or were they just?
No, they never came back. They in those days they used to send them down to Australia.
Uh-huh.
And then they'd ship them home from there, but they never came back into combat.
And that was what you would call combat fatigue, I guess.
Right.
Were there anybody that you think just faked it to get back?
No.
Or could you tell?
You could tell. And those that really went off the deep end, they were off.
There was no doubt about it.
No. No, they'd get hysterical and they'd do everything. They'd get their guns and fire them all over the place. That was one of the things you had to watch.
Ooh, they fired at friends.
Everybody. They went berserk. They had no idea what they were doing.
Oh, that didn't happen too often, I wouldn't guess.
No, either. Not too much, but it happened.
It did happen.
They never had to shoot them, but they got them.
Yeah. Okay, how about, I guess you never did get too many replacements in, or when the war in Europe was over, did you get some more people there to help?
We got more people over then, yeah. That's when it started to pick up. That was the change of the balance.
Spare parts and all the rest of it, huh?
Things started to come in.
What was your impression of your, let me ask you this. Did you work with any of our allies over there? Any of the Brits?
Oh, yeah. We had the Aussies there.
You had the Aussies, okay. Were they on the same base with you?
Yeah.
Flying combat missions and so forth?
Well, yes. They had the boomerangs. And I didn't know too much about the their planes. They were on a separate strip. But they were very good.
Did you have occasion to interact with them much?
No.
You kind of kept to yourself?
No, much too busy. We all had different missions.
Yeah.
And you all worked out your missions.
Yeah, so you didn't get together in any kind of activities. Huh? Okay. How did you learn about VE Day, just out of curiosity? Did somebody come to the loudspeaker, or what happened? How did you find out about that? That the Germans had surrendered.
Let's see, at that time that was in Okinawa, right?
Yes, probably would have been, would have been in Okinawa. Well, you're in Okinawa.
I guess intelligence picked it up and routed it through the different sources.
How did you personally hear about it? Could somebody just tell you, or did you hear it through?
No, we got an announcement through the magazine,
Stars
and Stripes. They had articles on it.
Oh, but you didn't know until you read Stars and Stripes.
Well, huh? We had some of the officers told us. And I remember at the end of the war over there, they had the Japanese fly over our strip when they were going down to surrender. And they flew over, and we saw that convoy come over.
What do you think about Hollywood movies and so forth of the war? Do you have any particular favorite films that you think maybe illustrate what you went through?
I don't think so.
No? They can't portray it the way it really is?
Not really. That's something you really can't duplicate.
Yeah. You gotta live it
To
really know it. Tell me about some of the people you saw. You already talked about Lindbergh, and you apparently met MacArthur, I guess, at one point, right?
I was in MacArthur's headquarters when I went up to New Guinea, when I first went up from New Guinea to go on up to the Shorten Islands. They took all the draftsmen off and brought them back to make maps for New Guinea and the whole area. And we did map works in MacArthur's headquarters. And we also pulled guard duty as extra work.
Did you have occasion to see him? And
that's when I met him. He came in late one night and I was on guard duty. And we sat down and shot the bull for a while.
What did you shoot the bull about? I mean,
he just wanted to know what my gripes were, what I liked.
He seemed interested in you.
He seemed interested in what the men were doing. And we just had a talk in general on what things were happening.
How did he strike you as a person in that quick interaction you had?
I thought he was quite sincere in what he was saying. And I felt better about him than I had prior to that, because I used to say I thought he was too much of a showman.
Yeah.
But when he talked to me, he seemed to strike me in a better frame.
Did you ever see any people like, say, Bob Hope or any USO people?
Yeah, we had Bob Hope over there, Francis Langford. We had Australian people come up that were actors, and they came up and performed for us.
Was that a pretty big deal to everybody?
That was a big deal. The one that I was disappointed in was Ray Bolger.
Uh-huh.
I was off duty on the day that he was supposed to come in, and I had to go down to the strip to pick him up.
Uh-huh.
And he was absolutely stoned. I put him in the back seat of the Jeep, and I brought him on back. He was laid across the Jeep, brought him on back and dumped him off in headquarters. And he couldn't even perform.
Oh, no.
And I thought it was terrible.
That is terrible.
And that was the last I saw of them.
Yeah.
But most of them were great.
I mean, they really really uplifted the morale of the troops.
Yeah, they did, because we weren't able to have any thing. Now, when they had a night when they were going to have a show, guys used to go 30 miles to go to that show.
Yeah.
And it was hard, and we used to travel all those miles and all the way back.
Yeah.
And when a guy pulled a stunt like he did, it was really a bummer.
Oh yeah. Your Bob Hope show, where did that occur? Was that in the Philippines or Okinawa or New Guinea, or do you recollect where it might have been?
Bob Hope.
That's all right.
I think he was on the Shulton Islands.
Shulton Islands, huh?
But he went on all the time. I mean, he was wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, he is a wonderful guy. Well, how about VJ Day? What happened? How did you learn about VJ Day? Or did you have some inkling that it was about to occur?
We knew that it was about to occur. And as I said before, they flew right over our strip when they came down.
Uh-huh.
I was surprised that somebody didn't take a shot at them when
they
came
over.
Say.
Yeah,
but they came over and they were escorted with a fighter group,
uh-huh.
And they brought them right in, and they brought them, and I think they went down to Manila, and then they had their negotiations there. MacArthur had issued orders that nobody was to shake hands with any of the Japs, and nobody did. It was a cold reception, but they came in and surrendered, and that was it.
Yeah. Okay, so VJ Day then occurred, and what happened to you then? I think your orders said you left on August 25th, or your orders were dated August 25th, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know when you actually did leave, but...
Well, that's the date that I left.
That is the date? So you actually left prior to the actual surrender ceremony then, the Missouri.
Yeah.
So you left that area. Right. Where did they send you right on August 25th then? Where did you?
August 25th.
Or whenever you left.
Let me look at this a minute.
Where did they send you to? Okay, so you were you got your orders on August 25th, and you didn't come back with your regular group.
No.
What happened?
I'd got malaria,
uh-huh.
And so they put me in a hospital, and I didn't go back with the regular group. That malaria is terrible. I never shook so much in my life. I used to have to stake down our bunks in the tents because we were on a hill.
Yeah.
And the guys would start shaking so much that the tents would
start moving. Moving down the hill.
We'd creep out
Good
from under the floor. So each one of the bunks had to be staked.
Oh, that's awful. So you were there. You had malaria. You didn't go back with your group. How long did you have? They had to. Get you in good enough health to leave, I guess.
Yeah. I had to run a fever that went up to 110.
No kidding.
And I just about kicked in.
Oh,
so
yes, you did.
I had to wait till I could get better health,
uh-huh.
And come back. And then, as I say, I came back with another group
entirely. So in September then? Sometime in September?
Yeah.
So you were there undergoing treatment for several weeks, I take it, then?
Right.
And then they, toward the end of
September?
I was there for
about 3 weeks, I think, after.
Okay.
I
so late September,
broke the fever.
Now, where did you go then when they sent you on? Did you go by vessel or fly home or what?
Let's see. Combination of both. Uh-huh. Flying and by boat.
Okay. You came into... the U.S. where San Francisco or
In Frisco.
And then what did they do then?
Well, they gave us deactivation, and we
got any bonus or back
pay? We got back pay and Well, we had a bonus later. See, the bonus that they had at that time was for your back pay and all that, and vacation pay and whatnot. Well, I never had any vacation, so I had the bonus was the max that they came up with. And I had that given to me. That was at Dix when I got there, and then I was...
You went to Fort Dix, I take it then?
Yeah,
From San Francisco.
Yeah, everybody came back to where they originated.
Now, you take a train, I take it, across the country? Or they fly, or what?
It was a train.
Train across the country.
Happiest train that you'd ever want to be on.
I bet there was some celebration.
Every time they stopped, the guys would get off the train and run into the nearest pub and down a few and get back.
Oh, boy.
That was a happy group. They dumped the water out of the water coolers and filled them up with liquor. You can get a drink of water on that train if you wanted it.
Is that right? So you're in Fort Dix there too, or how long did it take to actually get mustered out?
I think it was about almost a week.
And so what happened to your uniforms and everything? Did you have to turn them back in then, or what did they, did you keep anything?
No, I kept the uniforms.
Kept the uniform?
Yeah.
Still got it?
No more.
Okay.
So, no, I don't think I had anything. I had my insignias. Did I show you the group insignia? Yeah,
I think you did.
The Red Devil?
Yeah, I think I saw that.
I don't know what I did.
So anyway, from Fort Dix, then, what, they put you on a train or come back to?
Jet flag.
Where did you go after Fort Dix?
Fort Dix, I came home. Pardon me a minute.
Okay. Okay, so you left your 40th Fighter Squadron at Fort Dix officially.
Right.
And they put you on a, where were you living then? Bob, were you still in New Jersey then, or?
I was in New Jersey. I still came back to Nutley.
Came back to Nutley, okay.
Right.
And what was it like to be out of the service and back home? I mean, was it a big anticlimactic in a way?
It was kind of hard getting used to it. It was really great. And I had an officer one time, within about the first week that I was out, and I borrowed my mother's car, and he ran into the back end of my mother's car.
Oh, great.
So I had a few words for the officer. After I got rid of the irate, he looked at me and says, "How long have you been home, son?" Because he knew it was coming.
Yeah, I bet he did.
So,
okay. Any particularly very memorable humorous or sad incidents you can think of, Bob?
Overall?
Just kind of overall kind of high points that you recollect and really have lived with you through the years?
Not really. There are some, but I can't think of them offhand.
Well, you saw a lot of, I guess, saw some of your close friends were killed, I assume, with some of these bombing raids and strafing and what have you, and that had to be tough.
And I think the one thing that I really got a kick out of was this Daisy Cutter Hill that I mentioned.
Yeah.
That was quite a problem. And they thought that we were out and had come back into that area. And they came back and bombed us, and they dropped the whole bomb load right down the same area that they had before, but there was nobody there. And it was a complete waste.
Thank goodness.
But they got them all.
Yeah. Do you have anything you would say is the most memorable event that maybe it was VJ Day or getting out of the service or whatever?
Getting out of the service, of course, but... VJ Day was a great day.
Yeah.
Because, as I say, they came right over our camp.
Yeah.
And we knew who they were and where they were going.
So you could identify, you had enough practice, you knew what kind of planes were. What were the U.S. planes flying, or these Japanese planes flying?
They were, I think, mostly U.S.
Okay.
There might have been a Japanese plane there, but they were all Japanese officers.
People in,
come
in the
on
plane.
There. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And they brought them by.
Okay. Your experience during World War II changed you? How did it change your life or your outlook or whatever?
Anything well,
you can think of it.
Editor's note. End of tape B, side one. The interview continues on tape B, side two.
They got me a lot older than I was.
Fast.
And fast is right. And a lot more serious, I think. And I had a great respect for what we'd done, and I vowed that I would never stay over there. As a matter of fact, when before I came back, the fellows over there all wanted to stay and finish it off complete, because we didn't want a son.
What do you mean by that? What do you mean by that?
Well, we wanted to wipe Japan out.
Off the map.
Huh? I never got into Japan, but I wanted to make sure that they were completely destroyed. And I never wanted to have a son have to go back there.
Yeah.
And so we all wanted to stay until it was completed for sure. Because I didn't come back before a lot of this had really been settled. As I say, I never made it to Japan, which I was rather disappointed about that. I went to Okinawa, and that was the closest.
Yeah.
But I always wanted to finish it all the way
off
and get it over with.
Yeah. Have you ever really reflected on what you did and say, hey, was that really me, or was that another life, or yeah, does it seem real to you now?
Well, it's quite real. It always was. And
Even 50 plus years later, it's still real.
Yeah, because it's so tremendous at the time you're going through it. It's something you don't forget.
Yeah. Okay, you got anything else you'd like to add, Bob, to what we've talked about? I think we've covered things.
I think you've done pretty well with it, and I appreciate it.
Okay.
As I said before, I'm glad that you're doing this, because there's some people that don't appreciate what happened over those years.
That's exactly right.
And I know I mentioned this woman that used to work for us. When she asked me if I'd purchased all these things over there,
yeah,
had no concept of what the war was about.
Exactly.
And to bring that out to the people, I think it's something you need to
yeah,
do.
Yeah, I think this that's the whole idea. We want to put this in a place where people can look back and understand and hear in the words of the people who were there just what went on and what your thoughts were. Okay, Bob.
Okay.
Unless you have something else, I guess that'll conclude our interview with Bob Stark. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you very much.